First of all, a large chunk of the work was done by Amy Barger and Len Cowie and their graduate students, and my graduate student, Yuxuan Yang. So I'm sort of here for the ride sometimes, I feel. just to remind you, we all know what AGN are, basically radiating a lot of energy. And of course, as we've heard through this meeting, how you measure the luminosity and change with time are fundamental to their understanding of how they came to be. So this is the standard motivational plot. And one of the conclusions and one of the inputs to many of the theories we've seen so far is that they radiate a tremendous amount of energy over the life of the universe. It's really quite amazing that roughly 20% of the energy radiated in the universe comes from this tiny region in the center of galaxies compared to all the stars. This is the image of the field that contains about a third of the data we're talking about, the Chandra Large Area X-ray Survey Classics. And this is color-coded by X-ray hardness. These blobs here are not... that's because it's... not getting enough electrons. Okay. Yeah. And these are clusters that were found serendipitously in the field. They're photometric redshifts of roughly a half. Okay. This is the team, Yuxuan Yang at Maryland, the graduate student, and Peter Kapek, and I don't know Wang's first name.
Weihang
Wang. Len Cowie, who's here, Aaron Steffen. These are graduated students. This is still a graduate student. And Professor Amy Barger. There's roughly 400 kiloseconds of Chandra time here and many nights of Keck and Subaru time, plus the deepest ISO 90 and 170 micron data and scuba data. So there's an awful lot of analysis that's gone here. So for those of you who want to go to sleep for the rest of the talk, here's the conclusions. Basically, we've changed the number of AGN, the evolution of AGN, the nature of the hosts of AGN, the total energy radiated by AGN, and the correlation function of AGN. I believe we're all incorrectly estimated by optical and radio surveys obtained before 2 years ago. So there you go. Actually, the radio surveys are interesting because a lot of their results depend on optical follow-up work. And I think, in reality, the radio sources that were found actually have properties like the X-ray selected objects if they had ever published that. I'm going to claim, and I think we'll have some support, that the sources are very optically dim, and therefore I believe that only high-quality X-ray spectral and timing data can determine the nature of, I'll call this new class of objects, and set the basis of what I hope will be a better theory of AGN. So just to remind you what we knew before 2 years ago, based on the fantastic 2DF survey and everything else that was published since the late 1960s, these are the techniques that have been found to find AGN in the optical: strong, broad optical emission lines, presence of a semicellular nucleus, variability of the nucleus, unusual colors, optical counterparts to radio sources. As we heard earlier, large numbers are found out to redshifts of 6. Since the late 1960s, Martin Schmidt's seminal work, it's well known that quasars are much more numerous and luminous as you go further and further into the past. And here's this beautiful result that Brian Boyle published in 2000. Each one of these lines is a redshift slice. This is luminosity, the number of objects. And so as you go to higher and higher redshifts, there are more and more objects at each and every luminosity. And this thing just marches up beautifully. If you integrate this plot and project this in terms of total energy, this is the amount of energy radiated by the AGN as a function of redshift. It marches up quite nicely until it peaks at a redshift of 2.5, turns over, and this has been confirmed by the Sloan data. So if you're optically selected AGN, redshift 2.5 is the peak of the quasar energy density, and therefore quasars are created in the early universe. And as we've heard at this meeting, many theories were developed to explain this. So basically, we've gone out and gotten very large samples of AGN observed serendipitously with Chandra. This is the sum of three fields, the classics field, which I showed you a picture of earlier. I'll show you some details in a moment. The Chandra Deep Field North and the Chandra Deep Field South, and Len and Amy have done heroic work in getting the optical counterparts and the redshifts for very large numbers of these. This shows you that there's an awful lot of objects. This is just to convince you that this data set is rich. And here's the X-ray flux versus the optical magnitude. At high X-ray fluxes, one finds a very strong correlation between X-ray and optical magnitude. And one gets just to the region which Rosak got not get to, but which Chandra does beautifully, you get this slew of uncorrelated points. The light that one sees in the optical is not correlated with the light that one gets in the X-ray. Of course, these are all very, very faint. This is basically the limit for spectroscopic IDs of non-strong emission line objects. You can do better with strong emission line objects. And this is the completeness now as a function of X-ray flux. Almost everyone else plots it as a function of optical magnitude. But we thought this was quite entertaining, because as you get below this magic threshold of 10 to the minus 14, where there's no longer a correlation between the X-ray and optical, the fraction of objects that have optical spectroscopic redshifts just drops precipitously. And you can see this somewhat better here, where this is the fraction of objects with spectroscopic redshifts as a function of X-ray flux. And here's 10 to the minus 14. Why is this interesting? This is from a paper that Len published the other day. This is the luminosity, flux, I should say, at which the contribution of sources to the X-ray background peaks. So if you were interested in the problem of the X-ray background, which is the integrated light in the X-ray of AGN over all redshifts, this is the region you want to go to. So basically, roughly 80% of the sources at redshifts greater than this, where you get roughly 60% of the X-ray background, have spectroscopic redshifts. For those of you interested in the detail, there's four data sets, 1,406 objects with data, and here's the fractions of all the numbers. And you can read this in the paper. It appeared on AstroPH on Monday.
So it never drops much below half?
What doesn't drop? It reaches, never drops much below a half at down to the levels that people have obtained. The technical reason why, as you go fainter, and, well, you'll see in a moment, the fraction of objects that have strong spectroscopic features then is changing strongly with flux in the X-ray band. So there's a set of selection effects. In the Chandra Deep Field North, there are also photometric redshifts obtained by Hubble. So this is the distribution function of objects versus optical magnitude with spectroscopic redshifts. And then these are photometric redshifts, and these are ones without reasonable estimates. And things are rather quite complete down to 24.5 or maybe 25th magnitude in terms of spectroscopic and photometric redshifts. This is a projection of those data now in the redshift X-ray luminosity plane. This is the X-ray flux limit. The black circles are those with spectroscopic redshifts, and the open points are those with photometric redshifts. And the bottom line is that there is a weak bias in both redshift and in flux space. The ones with spectroscopic redshifts tend to be at slightly lower redshifts and tend to be obviously brighter. But it's not a radical bias. Just basically look at the open points versus the black points in this redshift luminosity domain. Okay, these are what these things look like with Hubble. This is taken from a PhD thesis by Manieri. It's nice because it's nice in color. I'll show you our plot in a moment. And the bottom line is that you can now see with Hubble the character of these objects. Basically, they tend to be spheroidal-like. Not all of them are, but they tend to be spheroids. And these are true colors, B, V, I, Z, and they're, I'll call it quasi-reddish. Now, of course, there's redshift effects and all sorts of things, but these do not look like the AGN that I learned in school. Now, many of you are younger than I, so maybe you learned something different in school, but when I was a graduate student, AGN were found in spiral galaxies. Seyfert's galaxies were all spirals. You can find maybe two spirals here. Also, you found that there tended to be moderate to low luminosity objects. In the local volume of space, there are basically no optically selected elliptical galaxies that are AGN in the local volume of space. So one immediately knows that one's seeing a different population than what was popular to teach a little while ago. Amy and Len have done a very nice job of actually characterizing these Hubble images. And basically, these are three different redshift slices, redshift of the half, one, and one and a half. These are objects with no point-like nucleus. These are ones with a point-like nucleus, and these are sort of intermediate. You can see this at each and every redshift. The bottom line is that in the Chandra-selected objects, 126 out of 286 do not have optical nuclei with HST. And these are just placed as upper limits up over here. All right? And so no matter how hard you try, you can't find them in the optical. There just is no nucleus. So by very simple construction, you're missing half of all the objects with any optical survey, unless you can build something better than Hubble, which we may have in a while. Now, the other thing is that there's a strong relationship between, in this plot, nucleated objects lie down here and unnucleated objects lie up here, and this is their optical spectroscopic character. These are your favorite broadline AGN. These are high excitation objects. These are objects that have lines that may come from star formation, but since these are all AGN, these are just lower ionization lines, and these are pure absorption line objects. All of the nucleated objects have broad optical lines. Surprise. That's how we found them to begin with a long time ago. What's interesting is that this vast panoply of objects that have nuclei that are much, much fainter than what we predict from the X-ray to optical correlations for broad line objects. The nucleus is often 5 magnitudes fainter than expected, and 3,000 angstroms if you have a galactic reddening curve, and of course we have no idea if we have a galactic reddening curve. This corresponds to a gas column of 10 to the 22 atoms per centimeter squared. Okay. I think this is a rather impressive number. Okay. So what are the properties of these objects? Well, first of all, you can estimate how many of them there are per solid angle at a fixed optical magnitude. That's just an observer's way of saying how rich is my data set. And the answer is basically the X-ray data sets of roughly 7 times the number of objects in an optically selected sample at the same optical magnitude. This is a convolution of 2 different selection functions. It's not just an entertaining number. So what are the properties? In a paper published last year by Aaron Stefan, Amy's former graduate student, this is the luminosity function, the number of AGN per unit luminosity, per unit volume, versus X-ray luminosity. So this is the total luminosity function here. And in purple here are those objects that have broad optical emission lines. So what you should notice is 2 things here. At high X-ray luminosities, virtually all of the X-ray selected AGN have broad optical lines. At low luminosities, virtually none do. This is expressed here in a histogram. Now, part of the problem we have here is that half of the objects don't have, in this field, this is the classics field, have accurate redshifts. So in a fit of conservatism, we placed all the objects without redshifts in this redshift shell between 0.1 and 1. So this is being ultra-conservative. This is the distribution function versus X-ray luminosity of those that have no AGN-type lines. These are the ones that have AGN-type lines. So below a characteristic luminosity of 10 to the 43.5 ergs per second, you can see it at the same place here, virtually none of the AGN in this sample have optical signatures. So you just miss them completely in an optical sample. Okay? They're not just a selection function, it's a killer selection function. So this type of result, so now we want to pursue this and do the luminosity function of AGN. Len did a first cut on this last year, where the data at that time only allowed him to do 2 redshift shells. And when you did this, you found that at redshift 0.1 to 1 and redshifts 2 to 4, the X-ray selected AGN had radically different luminosity functions. One got negative evolution at low X-ray luminosities. There were fewer objects at high redshift at low luminosity, and the number of objects at moderate luminosities was similar. Weta et al. Took a compilation of a variety of data, including the data here, and sliced this by luminosity. We saw this in Evan's talk earlier. And so now, in the Weta et al. Sample, which is about 1/3 the size of our sample, you can see this sliced by luminosity. So this is the high luminosity objects, just like the optical surveys. They're growing rapidly and then dropping at the highest redshifts. The intermediate luminosity are growing rapidly and then dropping, and the lowest luminosity are still growing today. We believe, and I'll show you reason to believe in 3 or 4 more slides, that these sources represent almost all of the AGN in the universe. Or to be more accurate, the X-ray samples completely recover the optical luminosity functions, which are the largest samples we have right now. And basically, all the broadline AGN in the Chandra Deep Field North and in Combo 17 are X-ray detected. So that's the best we can do right now. Okay, so what we've done in this paper is, because we have many more objects, we can now slice luminosity functions finer and actually watch this evolution change with redshift. This is the local X-ray luminosity function. This is LX here, 10 to the 42, 10 to the 46 ergs per second. This is the number per unit volume. This is taken from a very recent paper by Sazonov and Revnitsev, which used XTE data and updated something that I did 20 years ago, so this field's taken a long time to make any progress. And then on every plot, one sees this dark brown line just repeated. And so now we go from the local to 0.1 to 4, and you'll notice there's 2 lines here, the red line and the black line. The red line is the luminosity function, the X-ray luminosity function of broad line objects. Notice it does not continue up as one goes to lower in luminosities. It turns over. It turns over at every redshift. Right? What is that coming from? It's coming from the previous plot where there were no broadline AGN at low luminosity. So obviously the luminosity function has to turn over to tautology. This black line here is the total, so both the no line, I'll call them no line objects to make everyone annoyed, and the broad line objects. And you can see that there's a march. This is the local function plotted in each plot. It's just the function just marches systematically until you get to redshifts of 1.2. It's parameterized here in different shells. This is consistent, but I guess the right way of saying it's consistent with pure luminosity evolution out to redshifts of 1. And the important thing is that at redshifts greater than 1, the evolution radically changes. It changes sign. Okay. The data set is now large enough. In particular, the classics field gave you a large solid angle to normalize the low, relatively speaking, low redshift universe, to which one can compare the deep fields to normalize the relatively high redshift universe. So in each plot here, the orange line is the redshift 1 luminosity function from the previous plot. And now, at redshift, this is the total number of objects. The thing is wavy because of PowerPoint and me, so I apologize. This is the broad line function at redshift 1. What we have here are two separate symbols, the diamonds. The triangles are all objects, and the diamonds are the broad line objects. But these are the data. So at a redshift 1.5 to 3, there is a deficit below 10 to the 44 ergs per second of all types of objects. As one goes out to redshifts 3 to 5, that deficit continues. Now, there are other lines on this plot which represent attempts at correcting for incompleteness, and these are radically conservative attempts about placing all the unknown objects in the relevant redshift shell. That clearly cannot be correct. So, in our radical attempt to be conservative, we can almost accommodate no evolution at redshifts greater than 1, but that's it's not possible in both redshift shells. You have to accept a decline at whatever redshift you wish. And as you'll see in the next view graph, for those of you interested, this is our volume. This is the volume that one samples as a function of redshift. So this is basically getting about 10 to the 6 cubic comoving megaparsecs at redshifts of 1. So we're sampling quite nice volumes at redshifts greater than about 1/2. But at redshifts less than 1/2, our volume that we're sampling is less than 1,000 comoving megaparsecs, so we'll have some noise at those lower redshifts. Okay, so if you fit this law with an analytic function, so this is a broken power law, which is fit all AGN luminosity functions. These are the total objects, not the broad line objects. Remember, the broad line objects have this turned down, so this fit is not for the total objects. These are your characteristic parameters. Basically, there's a characteristic luminosity, 10 to the 44, which is clearly depends on what redshift one normalizes it. The low luminosity slope is very flat, 0.42. And the broad line objects have a negative low luminosity slope. That's what you saw in the previous plot. The high luminosity slope is almost similar between the narrow and the broad, 2.2 and 1.6. And this is the evolution parameter. Things are going as 1 plus z to the n, and n is about 3-ish. Out to redshifts of 1. As I showed you, it changes sign at redshifts greater than 1. So then one can integrate up the luminosity functions and get the total X-ray volume emissivity. This shows it split into two pieces. The blue, or whatever color this is, are the type 1 AGN, and the reds are the total sample. These are the ultra-conservative upper limits in each redshift shell, placing all those objects without redshifts in each shell separately. So these two points cannot both be correct. You have to accept either one or the other. These triangles and upper limits are from other surveys, stacking of Lyman Break galaxies done by Nandra and a recent paper by Lehman. And then at the very highest redshift, there's also an upper limit that comes from stacking. So if AGN live in those galaxies that are found by the color-selected surveys, these upper limits are relevant. If AGN don't live there, they're not relevant. But it's entertaining that they lie exactly along an extension of this data. So the bottom line is that at redshifts of 1, is the epoch at which AGN emit the most X-ray light. Okay, so obviously when you get results like this, someone says you're crazy. And so we have to ask ourselves, does it make any sense? One way to check is that can you reproduce the optical luminosity functions that other people have done? If we're right, an optically selected AGN or a subset of the X-ray selected AGN population, you should be able to do this. And we've done this now. The black points are the Kroom et al. Luminosity function in redshift shells. I'm sorry, you probably can't read these numbers. 0.55, 0.83, 1.1, 1.4, 1.87, and 1.9. The open points are the X-ray luminosity function for the broad line objects in those redshift shells. And what's amazing is that they overlap. Okay? There's no free parameters here. This is a direct comparison. And so I think we're fairly confident that we haven't screwed up in a major way, that we're able to reproduce a very large data set from our data. And notice this turn down here at lower luminosities in every redshift shell. So if you had extrapolated the total amount of AGN light by fitting an analytic function over here, you simply just got it wrong. And we've heard that now for 2.5 days at this meeting. Now, I personally believe that this turndown is not a true absence of AGN, but the physics of how broad lines are created. No one really knows why the broad line region exists, but there's lots of reasons to believe that it's a function of some property of the AGN. There's this huge class of objects called liners, which are clearly AGN without broad lines, and they're all low luminosity. This has been known for a long time. So please don't take this as the absence of black holes, but take these as the absence of objects which have broad lines. Okay. This just repeats that this characteristic turndown is seen at all redshifts, which is why I believe it's a piece of physics, but it changes in absolute luminosity. Okay. In other words, this place where the absence of broad line objects becomes strong is changing with redshift. So I think we have a nice little piece of physics here to explain. So just to repeat, other people have seen this as well. This is the same plot from Ueda et al. This has also been seen by Fiori et al, Marconi et al, and Hossinger et al. And Fiori has a nice plot which shows this. So this is, again, the downsizing, if you will. Each color here is a different X-ray luminosity. So this is 10 to the 43, 10 to the 44, 10 to the 44, 45, greater than 44.5, and you see exactly the same effects. And the famous quote, of course, through the looking glass is what I tell you three times is true. And I'm telling it to you four times, so it's even truer. Okay. So what does this mean for the energy density of the universe? So if you numerically integrate up and you apply a bolometric correction, and if I have time, I'll show you how we do the bolometric correction. You can just integrate up the AGN light. And this is that graph done by Marconi, and I'll show you ours in the next view graph. This is the amount of AGN light with the bolometric correction that one gets from the Boyle et al. Plots. This is redshift. This is the energy density per Z per comoving volume in CGS units. And basically, there's 5 times more AGN light in an X-ray selected sample, bolometric now, not X-ray. This is a bolometric correction applied to this. So you have. And Marconi et al. Used a very sophisticated and particular bolometric correction. We do a different one, and we come to qualitatively similar conclusions. I'll show you in the next view graph. So. I don't know. They're in Santa Monica. They're not radiating. We all know that when you look at nearby galaxies from dynamics, you infer massive black holes in the cores of nearby elliptical galaxies. There are now deep Chandra observations on many of these nearby ellipticals, and there's just nothing there. There are 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 9 of the Eddington limit. All right? So. Well, we'll come to that in 3 more slides. But you can't, I mean, just to go back, you cannot have properly accounted for the optical light until you had this plot. Right? These are the broad line objects. If you had numerically or analytically extended this luminosity function, you would have gotten the wrong answer. And I think that's what has happened. It's flat. It's It's even flatter than you had thought. It's minus a half, not minus 1.
Yeah, but then you're not adding much time.
Exactly. Well, it's a difference between the logarithm.
Error is 5% or 10%.
Okay.
I don't think
that's a big problem.
Well, that's compared with Krumen R, but it's not compared with Boyle R. It's a big correction.
Yeah.
Boyle R. And in fact, the things that Martin's quoting are based on the Boyle R.
Yeah, it's a factor of two different. Yeah, Krum is, as you just said, it's minus 1.1 in Krum. Ours is minus a half, so not a big deal. But also the characteristic luminosity changes a little bit, but I don't think that's a major effect. Now, in a particular model, as we've heard before, you can integrate up these plots, and depending on how you believe AGN evolve, so don't take these numbers seriously, but the character is correct. In this character, massive objects form early and don't grow very much. Lower mass objects form late and grow very, very rapidly. So this is a particular model of that effect, but these are the half and 90% accretion power points. But the qualitative result has to hold.
This is assuming basically luminosity is a fixed function of Eddington.
That's right. It's assuming that it's a constant efficiency and a fixed function of Eddington. And the bolometric correction factor is not a function of redshift or of absolute luminosity. So there's several sets of assumptions, a set of particular framework, but the qualitative result holds. This is our plot of the same thing. This is now in luminosity density per cubic megaparsec. This is the X-ray data. This is the Krum et al. Plot. And this is a log-log plot that's through 4 orders of magnitude. But basically, this is a factor of 3 to 5 at a redshift less than 1, the difference between the blue line and the orange points. And again, this peak of energy density, now this is integrating over everything, bolometric, is roughly redshifts of 1, and there's various correction incompleteness factors that are applied. Okay. And this has also been done now for the mass density. This is from I like to show results from other groups just to show you that the result that we're getting is not dependent on our sample or our analysis or our interpretation. We have the largest sample, so we have the smallest error bars, but it's a result that other people have obtained as well. So it's a robust result. In a particular implementation of this by Shankar et al., this is the growth of black hole mass versus cosmic time in X-ray selected. And again, the ropiness is me in PowerPoint. And the green is the optically selected AGN. So Martin, these folks doing the same thing that you have done get a Z equals 0 mass density of 1.5 times 10 to the 5 from the optical surveys. And taking the X-ray, you get 4 times 10 to the 5. This is the same plot from Shankar et al., where now the cumulative mass is done versus log mass of the black hole. The red is what one gets with optically selected surveys, and the black line, with uncertainty from their poorer sample, comes from the X-ray selected objects. So one gets a characteristic mass of roughly 10 to the 7.5. Okay? If you then do all this, find that optical surveys only account of the redshift 0 mass density of black holes. We've done this in a different way, and one gets qualitatively a very similar answer, where this is the bolometric correction factor that one uses from the X-ray to the total value. So we get X-ray 4 times 10 to the 5, remarkably what Shankar gets, and for the broad selected line objects, one gets 10 to the 5th with your usual Eddington corrections. So, and the bottom line is that half of the supermassive black hole mass density has formed at redshift less than 1. And since we're already bumping up against the best estimates at redshift 0 for the black hole mass, there isn't room for much else. All right? If you want to have other AGN than X-ray selected AGN, fine. But they cannot contribute much to the rest mass energy density at low redshift.
Your bottom plot there, the redshift from the luminosity function of galaxies and the black hole mass. So you can
correlation.
Check this directly.
I think in the Shankar paper they do that and they come to the same value, but then one has the additional assumption is how does this scale with redshift? This is with mass. It's a little bit higher. I think it's about 8 rather than 7.5 is what I remember when you do that with the sigma correlation. You use a distribution function of sigma. Isn't that in the Kaufman paper? I think it's like 10 to the 8th is what you get. So it's close but not exactly the same. I'll skip over this. Okay, this is how the... So, how much time do I have left? Oh my gosh. Anyhow, so what are the properties of these objects? This is a beautiful picture of the classics field taken with Subaru. That's a prime camera. So these are the optical properties of those galaxies. This is the track of a giant elliptical in redshift space. So they have similar but slightly bluer colors to ellipticals. This is the absolute magnitude. And I'll, since I only have 5 minutes, I'll skip, go to the next plot. So in the Chandra Deep Field North, where the Hawaii team have obtained redshifts for virtually every galaxy inside the field, so these are all the galaxies inside the field with symbols, the Chandra sources and the black squares are the broad line objects, and the open, the orange things are the narrower no line objects. They lie at every redshift along the brightest galaxies. So this is redshift 0, redshift 1.5. This is all the galaxies in the field. The Chandra sources are well indicated. And while they're not necessarily the very brightest galaxy at every redshift, in particular the black squares have AGN light that contribute to the rest frame magnitude. So look at the orange symbols where there's very little, if any, AGN light. They just lie along the sequence of the brightest galaxies at every redshifts. Okay. One can then look at this as a function of redshift. So this is the galaxy absolute magnitude. This is redshift. The triangles are the most luminous sources. The squares are the less luminous, and the dots are the least luminous. And one finds, as one goes to lower and lower redshifts, the hosts tend to be dimmer and dimmer in absolute magnitude space. So at high redshifts, you see these incredible objects. This is, I'm not an expert here on absolute magnitude at 5,000 angstroms, but these are very, very, very luminous galaxies, and they just do not seem to be prominent or present at the lower redshifts. This is downsizing. The AGN are living in smaller and smaller galaxies as one's going to lower and lower redshifts. And the AGN themselves are lower and lower luminosity as one's going to lower and lower redshifts. So one can now look at the characteristic magnitude for the whole survey. So that previous plot now compressed down into one bin. And so the objects without optical emission lines tend to have an absolute B magnitude, which I do understand, of minus 22. The hatched are those, the black line are the broad line objects, and histogram are those intermediate objects. So basically, these are massive galaxies. The broad line objects tend to be higher redshifts. So the broad line objects are the black points. The non-broad line AGN are the red points. It's a term of optical magnitude. And so this is the point you were making earlier. Oh, yes, right. As one goes, at every optical magnitude, the non-broad line AGN tend to be at lower and lower redshifts. So you do have this strong selection effect. Are these AGN? Many people have said, well, they're X-ray sources. How do you know they're AGN? Well, we've looked at their X-ray time variability characteristics, and we've normalized them to the low redshift samples. This is taken from Ian George's paper in 2000. This is the variance at a fixed characteristic time scale versus X-ray luminosity. This is the variance at a different X-ray characteristic time scale, so the absolute numbers are different versus X-ray luminosity. And they're variable. They're variable at about the right magnitude. So these are variable, point-like, luminous X-ray sources in the center of galaxies. If they're not AGN, give me something else. What's really weird to me is that the redshift is constant. As one goes fainter and fainter in X-ray flux, this is the median redshift. These are all the points. These are lines of constant luminosity. And one basically finds that these objects seem to... So this is the pathology that I think drove us all crazy at the beginning. As you went fainter and fainter, you didn't find more and more distant objects. You found lower and lower luminosity objects. Totally contrary to what we expected. But this is the plot. And now I'm getting down to the last thing I guess I want to show. This is the fraction of objects that are broad line as a function of X-ray luminosity in different redshift shells. And basically, it's at every redshift shell, you see the same thing. When it goes to lower and lower X-ray luminosities, you get fewer and fewer broad line objects. But the character of the curves is changing subtly with redshift. So there's something going on. So what do we think is going on? Well, at the very minimum, what's going on is that a large fraction of the no-line objects have X-ray absorption in the line of sight. We know that is happening. There may be other things that are happening, but we don't know that yet. What you see here is this is the line width of the objects. all the broad line objects, this is a line that corresponds to an X-ray spectrum with no photoelectric absorption. If objects lie along this plot, they are well fit by simple power laws. The broad line objects, with a few exceptions, are well fit by simple power laws. The narrow line objects are never fit by simple power laws. Their spectra are more complex. This can be interpreted as photoelectric absorption, but is not a unique indicator from our relatively lower quality spectroscopic data. So, give me one more minute. This is the spectral energy distribution function of the objects stacked in luminosity space. And what you find basically is that the broad line AGN that we find tend to have the same spectral energy distribution. This is the photometry in bands. This is the stacked quasar spectra from, I guess it's green et al. And they just fit exactly. As one drops in luminosity, the objects get UV dimmer. So you don't find them in color-selected or UV-selected surveys. They're just gone. One then combines all these samples into spectral energy distributions for the broad line and the narrow line objects. And it's fair to say that qualitatively, the narrow line objects look like the classical heavily obscured narrow line or no line object, NGC 6240, which Gunther Hossinger has used as a template for all of these objects. So, yeah, I'm going to ignore the large-scale structure, except we got it measured. Maybe someone has a question on that. Okay, so the summary is the majority of AGN in the universe are not like optically selected AGN. Most of the sources are optically dull and radio quiet. Obtaining optical redshifts is difficult, so all you people with 8 or 10 meter telescopes. Redshift 1 is the peak epoch of AGN, where the energy density peaks can peak consistent with the peak in the integral star formation rate, which no one's talked about at this meeting yet. AGN evolved very rapidly to redshifts of 1, consistent with pure luminosity evolution. But at higher redshift, the evolution changes sign. This is a gross effect. Half of the nuclei are not detected by Good's HST imaging in the Z-band. So if you want to find them optically, you've got to get yourself a bigger optical telescope or almost surely go to the IR. And therefore, if you want to figure out what they are, you need better X-ray data. And there's a nice recent result from Gunther Hossinger on that. There's a lot more energy radiated by AGN. Now, when I say larger than previously thought, that's based on our new correction factors. Of course, one could argue about that point. The Chandra objects can produce all of the redshift zero mass black holes via accretion from redshifts of 3. Okay? So if you want to do them some other way, you're going to have to break one of our assumptions. Optically selected objects are a subset of X-ray selected objects, which we didn't know before. The data are consistent with many of the non-broad line objects having high column densities. This is not a unique solution, but it's the preferred solution right now. The host galaxies tend to be the most luminous galaxies at each redshift. And the data point to downsizing. Massive luminous systems dominate high redshifts, low mass luminosity at lower redshifts, I think. The last one. And the simple unified model is not correct. You do not have the same covering fraction by a torus or a cold material in the line of sight at low luminosities as you have at high luminosities. That's the Stefan effect. At low luminosities, you have more covering fraction / more obscuration. I think that's enough conclusions from one paper.
So, Richard, I can't say
what you've heard this.
I can't say what's going on at a redshift of 1.
Yeah.
But I think I know with a lot of information about what's going on at Z of 0.1, which isn't, after all, so much lower in redshift than the lowest redshift bins you showed. And I think it's clear from the Sloan data that if you actually get good optical spectra and dig down into the dirt, that in fact you can follow the luminosity function of both the narrow line and the broad line objects way down below where you're claiming to see this rollover. And so I would say I would strenuously disagree with your last point, because in the Sloan galaxy sample, the ratio of type 1 and type 2 AGN varies hardly at all as you go far down below the luminosity where you're seeing this rollover in the, the X-ray data. And I think I agree with most of what you said, but I think you're underestimating the importance of just aperture dilution, that optical surveys that pick out AGN only when the contrast of the AGN with its host galaxy is large will surely be very incomplete, and I think it's responsible for most of what you're finding. Okay. But I mean, I certainly agree that at high redshift, X-rays are a better way of finding AGN than optical.
Yeah, I mean, Lewis Ho has, you know, done this digging around in the dirt, and you have to subtract out the absorption line spectra of the stars and all that, and we clearly haven't done that.
Can I say something about Z-Gray doesn't see AGNs? So
yeah, we said something a little bit. Go ahead.
Well, maybe I missed.
Okay, sure.
There were rumors at some point that X-ray selected samples include more high redshift quasars than seen in optical selected samples.
In the ROSAT surveys that were published by Miyagi and Hassinger et al., there was not a hint. There was a hint of a, going to the Sloan data, there's a strong decline at high redshifts and selection function. In the ROSAT data, there was a 2-sigma indication of the continuity that wasn't a drop-off. I think it's fair to say that it's hard to put these data into that context, actually. But if you just look here, at the high luminosity end, this is the redshift 1 total luminosity function. At the high luminosity end, there is no detected evolution yet in the X-ray selected surveys in this redshift bin. And we don't have, I believe there's only 2 objects at redshifts greater than 5. So there's very little information at higher redshifts. So just focusing here right now, there is not yet an indication in an X-ray selected sample of a turn down in volume density at high redshifts.
So it's there is no, so then it disagrees with optical.
No, no.
Well, most luminous objects, the density is the same at redshift 1 and redshift 4. Right?
Yeah.
But I think at individual luminosity,
yeah, here you can see it. At intermediate luminosities, it's dropping.
I'm not even sure it's even
yeah. Now, the optically selected surveys, help me out here, minus 26.5 is about 10 to the 45.5 in X-rays. The very bright end. So the Sloan data are relevant here. Sloan data are relevant here. There is no, maybe the Combo 17 can talk about these luminosities, but certainly not from the Sloan.
Well, on the redshift evolution, we can certainly say that we see a peak just from broadline or type 1 AGN alone. We see a peak that seems to move on to even higher redshifts when we go to higher luminosities. So there is a trend, taking all various surveys together, that ties in with what is seen towards much lower luminosities in the X-rays. However, this is not an effect due to, say, changing absorption properties, but it seems to be physical in the population properties, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Just one more comment. We also see, by really careful AGN host galaxy modeling, that the AGN hosts, even of the relatively luminous objects, tend to be luminous galaxies. They're not among the most luminous galaxies. So I think if one really looks into this very carefully, they are among the more luminous, but the most luminous are really something else. They tend not to have AGN. And I have a question, Richard.
Sure.
Your new picture is able to predict the X-ray background?
Yes. Well, actually, we've done it numerically by integrating up the log n log s plot, but only out to 6 keV. So I'm going to follow that up and take an opportunity to say something different that I don't have a view graph for. But as one goes above 6 keV, this population that you've just seen provides less and less and less of the X-ray background. This has been three papers, I guess Bargerd all 2003, and there's a recent Fabian paper. And so there is another, yet still another population of AGN that are even more obscured, that are appearing at higher energies in the X-ray band. Now, if those objects are not to exceed the rest mass zero density of black holes, they have to be very low luminosity and very low redshift. And in a modeling exercise, Fabian's group finds an expectation value of a redshift of 1 for these systems and an X-ray luminosity of 10 to the 43. So there's a lot of them. They're very numerous, but their total emissivity is small. That's the numbers, and I can say is that it even lower. No, I mean, what they've done is a very coarse fit.
As long as you keep the X-ray background at a relatively low redshift, you will not get the black hole mass density wrong.
Yeah. You're already claiming that this population produces a small fraction of the low X-ray background.
Well, but you're only bumping up to the black hole. You're only talking about the background.
Well, remember, we have four assumptions. The efficiency is 0.1 and constant with redshift and luminosity. The bolometric correction factor is the same at all redshifts and luminosities, but for these two different classes. All right? And you break one of those assumptions, and these numbers will change accordingly. But we can't do anything else right now. We don't have the data that allow us to break those assumptions. But when I'm going to add a new population of AGN in, we may have to break one of those assumptions.
In your outline, you said you find different clustering properties between the X-ray selector and the optically selector. Can you comment a bit more about that?
Yeah. It turns out, okay, so just to show you the gross clustering. So these are now simply the number of objects per unit solid angle at a fixed X-ray luminosity in 12 different fields. Okay. And what you're supposed to see is that two of these fields are many, many sigma away from the mean. So there is cosmic variance. That's all this plot's supposed to show, is that cosmic variance exists. So then you can try to do the angular correlation function. And we did this for the soft X-ray selected objects and the hard X-ray selected objects. And the red line would be the angular correlation function from an optically selected survey, which is similar to the X-rays. Now, in order to invert this to, and this is simply the image to show you the clustering in physical space, in angular space. These results have been confirmed by another group using XMM data, Vasilikos et al., that find the clustering of hard X-ray selected AGN. So that's all we can say about the angular clustering. The angular clustering is stronger than one would anticipate on the basis of the Limber equation inversion. Thanks to all the redshifts that Len, and this just shows you the well-known fact that, at least in the deep fields, a lot of these objects occur in strong sheets. These are from the Chandra deep field north and south. In our field, my graduate student Yuxuan Yang has now got the three-dimensional correlation function using the redshifts, but we can't slice it by hard sources and soft sources. We don't have enough objects to do that yet. And so this is actually numerically dominated by the soft sources. And here is the correlation function now with redshift in our X-ray selected samples. There are these four circles. These two points were published recently from the Chandra Deep Field South, the Chandra Deep Field North. These triangles here are the 2DF, and this point here is from ROSAT at low redshift by Chris Mullis. So at 1 sigma, there is a change in the correlation function with redshift, or maybe it's 2 sigma, but I wouldn't shout about it right now.
Can you slice it by luminosity?
We can slice it by luminosity, have not done so. This is hot off the computer last week. So I don't think you've seen this yet. So this is to show you that we actually do detect the correlation function as a function of angle. So yeah, we can slice it by luminosity, but we can't slice it by type yet. And if we slice it by luminosity, we can't get the redshift coverage.
Do you find any sources in dwarf galaxies?
No. Len actually remarked upon that in the first paper in 2000, in the Nature paper, that there were no dwarf galaxies that were X-ray selected AGN. And actually, in the local volume of the universe, we have these large serendipitous surveys right now. And to my knowledge, no one has found an X-ray. I've got to be careful. Sorry. I'm about to make a definition statement. there are other objects called ultra-luminous X-ray binaries.
No, I mean something a bit more.
No, I'm just going to tell you, we have a problem, is that when you get below 10 to the 40, 1.5 ergs per second, okay, then you don't know what it is you're looking at.
Well, I was more thinking about a 10 to the 5 solar mass black hole or something like that.
Yeah, that's the problem. Well, a 10 to the 5 solar mass black hole, 0.01 Eddington, is 10 to the 41 ergs per second. And so when we see one of those objects, even though it's in the nucleus, we don't know what it is.
Yeah, and you might like to see some at Eddington luminosity.
Sorry?
See some at Eddington luminosity at some stage.
I don't believe we've ever seen one of those so far. After all, we only have 1,409 objects, so they must be rare. but I should say, just as an aside, the nucleus of M33, a very nearby grand design spiral, has been a point-like X-ray source for 20 years. It was discovered in the Einstein Observatory. It's about 10 to the 39 ergs per second, and there is no optical counterpart. So either it's an AGN with a very, and there's no X-ray absorption either. So either it's a very, very high X-ray to optical ratio object, or it's something that, a new category of a thing, these ultra-luminous X-ray sources. Yeah, two papers, 10 to the 5th and what? 10 to the 4th. No, but there's none in dwarfs so far. So I think we would say that there are very few radiating massive black holes in dwarfs. And I've been working on some nearby galaxies with a graduate student, and there's lots and lots of nuclear emission, these point sources in the nuclei of rather low luminosity. They're very common. Well, that's the end of the day.